Chapter 48, Section 3. Vulgar economy actually does no more than interpret, systematize, and defend in doctrinaire fashion the conceptions of the agents of bourgeois production who are entrapped in bourgeois production relations. It should not astonish us, then, that vulgar economy feels particularly at home in the estranged outward appearances of economic relations in which these prima facie absurd and perfect contradictions appear, and that these relations seem the more self-evident the more their internal relationships are concealed from it, although they are understandable to the popular mind. But all science would be superfluous if the outward appearance and the essence of things directly coincided. Thus, vulgar economy has not the slightest suspicion that the trinity which it takes as its point of departure, namely land, rent, capital, interest, labour, wages, or the price of labour, are prima facie three impossible combinations. First, we have the use-value land, which has no value, and the exchange value, rent. So that a social relation conceived as a thing is made proportional to nature, that is, two incommensurable magnitudes are supposed to stand in a given ratio to one another. Then, capital interest. If capital is conceived as a certain sum of values represented independently by money, then it is prima facie nonsense to say that a certain value should be worth more than it is worth. It is precisely in the form capital interest that all intermediate links are eliminated and capital is reduced to its most general formula, which therefore in itself is also inexplicable and absurd. The vulgar economist prefers the formula capital interest, with its occult quality of making a value unequal to itself, to the formula capital profit, precisely for the reason that this already more nearly approaches actual capitalist relations. Then again, driven by the disturbing thought that 4 is not 5, and that 100 shillings cannot possibly be 110 shillings, he flees from capital as value to the material substance of capital, to its use value as a condition of production of labour, to machinery, raw materials, etc. Thus he is able once more to substitute, in place of the first incomprehensible relation whereby 4 equals 5, a wholly incommensurable one between a use value, a thing on one side, and a definite social production relation, surplus value, on the other, as in the case of landed property. As soon as the vulgar economist arrives at this incommensurable relation, everything becomes clear to him, and he no longer feels the need for further thought, for he has arrived precisely at the rational in bourgeois conception. Finally, labour wages, or price of labour, is an expression as shown in Volume 1, which prima facie contradicts the conception of value as well as of price, the latter generally being but a definite expression of value. And price of labour is just as irrational as a yellow logarithm. But here the vulgar economist is all the more satisfied, because he has gained the profound insight of the bourgeois, namely that he pays money for labour. And since precisely the contradiction between the formula and the conception of value relieves him from all obligation to understand the latter, we have seen that the capitalist process of production is a historically determined form of the social process of production in general. The latter is as much a production process of material conditions of human life as a process taking place under specific historical and economic production relations, producing and reproducing these production relations themselves, and thereby also the bearers of this process, their material conditions of existence, and their mutual relations. That is, their particular socio-economic form. For the aggregate of these relations, in which the agents of this production stand with respect to nature and to one another, and in which they produce, is precisely society, considered from the standpoint of its economic structure. Like all its predecessors, the capitalist process of production proceeds under definite material conditions, which are, however, simultaneously the bearers of definite social relations entered into by individuals in the process of reproducing their life. Those conditions, like these relations, are on the one hand prerequisites, on the other hand results and creations of the capitalist process of production. They are produced and reproduced by it. We saw also that capital, and the capitalist is merely capital personified and functions in the process of production solely as the agent of capital, in its corresponding social process of production, pumps a definite quantity of surplus labour out of the direct producers or labourers. Capital obtains this surplus labour without an equivalent, and in essence it always remains forced labour, no matter how much it may seem to result from free contractual agreement. This surplus labour appears as surplus value, and this surplus value exists as a surplus product. Surplus labour in general, as labour performed over and above the given requirements, must always remain. In the capitalist as well as in the slave system, etc., it merely assumes an antagonistic form and is supplemented by complete idleness of a stratum of society. A definite quantity of surplus labour is required as insurance against accidents, and by the necessary and progressive expansion of the process of reproduction in keeping with the development of the needs and the growth of population, which is called accumulation from the viewpoint of the capitalist. It is one of the civilizing aspects of capital that it enforces this surplus labour in a manner and under conditions which are more advantageous to the development of the productive forces, social relations, and the creation of the elements for a new and higher form than under the preceding forms of slavery, serfdom, etc. Thus it gives rise to a stage, on the one hand, in which coercion and monopolization of social development, including its material and intellectual advantages, by one portion of society at the expense of the other, are eliminated. On the other hand, it creates the material means and embryonic conditions which make it possible in a higher form of society to combine this surplus labour with a greater reduction of time devoted to material labour in general. For, depending on the development of labour productivity, surplus labour may be large in a small total working day, and relatively small in a large total working day. If the necessary labour time equals 3, and the surplus labour equals 3, then the total working day equals 6, and the rate of surplus labour equals 100%. If the necessary labour equals 9, and the surplus labour equals 3, then the total working day equals 12, and the rate of surplus labour only 33 1/3%. In that case, it depends upon the labour productivity, how much use value shall be produced in a definite time, hence also in a definite surplus labour time. The actual wealth of society, and the possibility of constantly expanding its reproduction process, therefore, do not depend upon the duration of surplus labour, but upon its productivity, and the more or less copious conditions of production under which it is performed. In fact, the realm of freedom actually begins only where labour, which is determined by necessity and mundane considerations, ceases. Thus, in the very nature of things, it lies beyond the sphere of actual material production. Just as the savage must wrestle with nature to satisfy his wants, to maintain and reproduce life, so must civilized man, and he must do so in all social formations and under all possible modes of production. With his development, this realm of physical necessity expands as a result of his wants, but at the same time the forces of production which satisfy these wants also increase. Freedom in this field can only consist in socialized man, the associated producers, rationally regulating their interchange with nature, bringing it under their common control instead of being ruled by it as by the blind forces of nature, and achieving this with the least expenditure of energy and under conditions most favourable to and worthy of their human nature. But it nonetheless still remains a realm of necessity. Beyond it begins that development of human energy which is an end in itself, the true realm of freedom, which, however, can blossom forth only with this realm of necessity as its basis. The shortening of the working day is its basic prerequisite. In a capitalist society, this surplus value, or this surplus product, leaving aside chance fluctuations in its distribution and considering only its regulating law, its standardizing limits, is divided among capitalists as dividends proportionate to the share of the social capital each holds. In this form, surplus value appears as average profit, which falls to the share of capital, an average profit which in turn divides into profit of enterprise and interest, and which under these two categories may fall into the laps of different kinds of capitalists. This appropriation and distribution of surplus value, or surplus product, on the part of capital, however, has its barrier in landed property. Just as the operating capitalist pumps surplus labour, and thereby surplus value and surplus product in the form of profit, out of the labourer, so the landlord, in turn, pumps a portion of this surplus value or surplus product out of the capitalist, in the form of rent, in accordance with the laws already elaborated. Hence, when speaking here of profit as that portion of surplus value falling to the share of capital, we mean average profit, equal to profit of enterprise plus interest, which is already limited by the deduction of rent from the aggregate profit, identical in mass with aggregate surplus value. The deduction of rent is assumed. Profit of capital, profit of enterprise plus interest, and ground rent are thus no more than particular components of surplus value, categories by which surplus value is differentiated depending on whether it falls to the share of capital or landed property, headings which in no whit, however, alter its nature. Added together, these form the sum of social surplus value. Capital pumps the surplus labour, which is represented by surplus value and surplus product, directly out of the labourers. Thus, in this sense, it may be regarded as the producer of surplus value. Landed property has nothing to do with the actual process of production. Its role is confined to transferring a portion of the produced surplus value from the pockets of capital to its own. However, the landlord plays a role in the capitalist process of production, not merely through the pressure he exerts upon capital, nor merely because large landed property is a prerequisite and condition of capitalist production, since it is a prerequisite and condition of the expropriation of the labourer from the means of production, but particularly because he appears as the personification of one of the most essential conditions of production. Finally, the labourer, in the capacity of owner and seller of his individual labour power, receives a portion of the product under the label of wages, in which that portion of his labour appears, which we call necessary labour, that is, that required for the maintenance and reproduction of this labour power. Be the conditions of this maintenance and reproduction scanty or bountiful, favourable or unfavourable. Whatever may be the disparity of these relations in other respects, they all have this in common. Capital yields a profit year after year to the capitalist, land a ground rent to the landlord, and labour power, under normal conditions and so long as it remains useful labour power, a wage to the labourer. These three portions of total value annually produced, and the corresponding portions of the annually created total product, leaving aside for the present any consideration of accumulation, may be annually consumed by their respective owners, without exhausting the source of their reproduction. They are like the annually consumable fruits of a perennial tree, or rather three trees. They form the annual incomes of three classes: capitalist, landowner, and labourer, revenues distributed by the functioning capitalist in his capacity as direct extorter of surplus labour and employer of labour in general. Thus, capital appears to the capitalist, land to the landlord, and labour power, or rather labour itself, to the labourer, since he actually sells labour power only as it is manifested, and since the price of labour power, as previously shown, inevitably appears as the price of labour under the capitalist mode of production, as three different sources of their specific revenues, namely profit, ground rent, and wages. They are really so in the sense that capital is a perennial pumping machine of surplus labour for the capitalist, land a perennial magnet for the landlord, attracting a portion of the surplus value pumped out by capital, and finally, labour, the constantly self-renewing condition and ever self-renewing means of acquiring, under the title of wages, a portion of the value created by the labourer, and thus a part of the social product measured by this portion of value, that is, the necessities of life. They are so, furthermore, in the sense that capital fixes a portion of the value, and thereby of the product of the annual labour, in the form of profit. Landed property fixes another portion in the form of rent, and wage labour fixes a third portion in the form of wages, and precisely by this transformation converts them into revenues of the capitalist, landowner, and labourer, without, however, creating the substance itself which is transformed into these various categories. The distribution rather presupposes the existence of this substance, namely the total value of the annual product, which is nothing but materialized social labour. Nevertheless, it is not in this form that the matter appears to the agents of production, the bearers of the various functions in the production process, but rather in a distorted form. Why this takes place will be developed in the further course of our analysis. Capital, landed property, and labour appear to those agents of production as three different independent sources, from which, as such, there arise three different components of the annually produced value, and thereby the product in which it exists. Thus, from which there arise not merely the different forms of this value as revenues falling to the share of particular factors in the social process of production, but from which this value itself arises, and thereby the substance of these forms of revenue. It might seem as if a rational relation were expressed at least in labour wages. But this is no more the case than with land ground rent. Insofar as labour is value-creating and is manifested in the value of commodities, it has nothing to do with the distribution of this value among various categories. Insofar as it has the specifically social character of wage labour, it is not value-creating. It has already been shown, in general, that wages of labour, or price of labour, is but an irrational expression for the value or price of labour power, and the specific social conditions under which this labour power is sold have nothing to do with labour as a general agent in production. Labour is also materialised in that value component of a commodity which, as wages, forms the price of labour power. It creates this portion just as much as the other portions of the product. But it is materialised in this portion no more and no differently than in the portions forming rent or profit. And, in general, when we establish labour as value-creating, we do not consider it in its concrete form as a condition of production, but in its social delimitation, which differs from that of wage labour. Even the expression capital profit is incorrect here. If capital is viewed in the only relation in which it produces surplus value, namely, its relation to the labourer, whereby it extorts surplus labour by compulsion exerted upon labour power, that is, the wage labourer, then this surplus value comprises, outside of profit, profit of enterprise plus interest, also rent. In short, the entire undivided surplus value. Here, on the other hand, as a source of revenue, it is placed only in relation to that portion falling to the share of the capitalist. This is not the surplus value which it extracts generally, but only that portion which it extracts for the capitalist. Still more does all connection vanish, no sooner the formula is transformed into capital interest. If we at first considered the disparity of the three sources, we now, secondly, note that their products, their offshoots or revenues, on the other hand, all belong to the same sphere, that of value. However, this is compensated for, this relation not only between incommensurable magnitudes, but also between wholly unlike, mutually unrelated and non-comparable things, in that capital, like land and labour, is simply considered as a material substance, that is, simply as a produced means of production, and thus is abstracted both as a relation to the labourer and as value. Thirdly, if understood in this way, the formula capital interest, that is profit, land rent, labour wages, presents a uniform and symmetrical incongruity. In fact, since wage labour does not appear as a socially determined form of labour, but rather all labour appears by its nature as wage labour, appearing thus to those in the grip of capitalist production relations, the definite specific social forms assumed by the material conditions of labour, the produced means of production and the land, with respect to wage labour, just as they in turn conversely presuppose wage labour, directly coincide with the material existence of these conditions of labour, or with the form possessed by them generally in the actual labour process, independent of its concrete, historically determined social form, or indeed, independent of any social form. The changed form of the conditions of labour, that is, alienated from labour and confronting it independently, whereby the produced means of production are thus transformed into capital and the land into monopolised land or landed property, this form, belonging to a definite historical period, thereby coincides with the existence and function of the produced means of production and of the land in the process of production in general. These means of production are in themselves capital by nature. Capital is merely an economic appellation for these means of production. And similarly, in itself, land is by nature the earth, monopolized by a certain number of landowners. Just as products confront the producer as an independent force in capital and capitalists, who actually are but the personification of capital, so land becomes personified in the landlord, and likewise gets on its hind legs to demand, as an independent force, its share of the product created with its help. Thus, not the land receives its due portion of the product for the restoration and improvement of its productivity, but instead the landlord takes a share of this product to sell off or squander. It is clear that capital presupposes labour as wage labour. But it is just as clear that if labour as wage labour is taken as the point of departure, so that the identity of labour in general with wage labour appears to be self-evident, then capital and monopolised land must also appear as the natural form of the conditions of labour in relation to labour in general. To be capital, then, appears as the natural form of the means of labour, and thereby as the purely real character arising from their function in the labour process in general. Capital and produced means of production thus become identical terms. Similarly, land and land monopolised through private ownership become identical. The means of labour as such, which are by nature capital, thus become the source of profit, much as the land as such becomes the source of rent. Labour as such, in its simple capacity as purposive productive activity, relates to the means of production, not in their social determinate form, but rather in their concrete substance, as material and means of labour. The latter, likewise, are distinguished from one another merely materially, as use values, that is, the land as unproduced, the others as produced, means of labour. If, then, labour coincides with wage labour, so does the particular social form in which the conditions of labour confront labour coincide with their material existence. The means of labour as such are then capital, and the land as such is landed property. The formal independence of these conditions of labour in relation to labour, the unique form of this independence with respect to wage labour, is then a property inseparable from them as things, as material conditions of production, an inherent, intrinsic character of them as elements of production. Their definite social character, in the process of capitalist production bearing the stamp of a definite historical epoch, is a natural and intrinsic substantive character belonging to them, as it were, from time immemorial, as elements of the production process. Therefore, the respective part played by the earth, as the original field of activity of labour, as the realm of forces of nature, as the pre-existing arsenal of all objects of labour, and the other respective part, played by the produced means of production, instruments, raw materials, etc., in the general process of production, must seem to be expressed in the respective shares claimed by them as capital and landed property, that is, which fall to the share of their social representatives in the form of profit or interest and rent, just as to the labourer the part his labour plays in the process of production is expressed in wages. Rent, profit, and wages thus seem to grow out of the role played by the land, produced means of production, and labour in the simple labour process, even when we consider this labour process as one carried on merely between man and nature, leaving aside any historical determination. It is merely the same thing again in another form when it is argued, the product in which a wage labourer's labour for himself is manifested, his proceeds or revenue, is simply wages. The portion of value, and thereby the social product measured by this value, which his wages represent. Thus, if wage labour coincides with labour generally, then so do wages with the produce of labour, and the value portion representing wages with the value created by labour generally. But in this way, the other portions of value, profit and rent, also appear independent with respect to wages, and must arise from sources of their own, which are specifically different and independent of labour. They must arise from the participating elements of production, to the share of whose owners they fall. That is, profit arises from the means of production, the material elements of capital, and rent arises from the land or nature, as represented by the landlord. Roscher, System der Volkswirtschaft, Volume 1, Die Grundlagen der Nationalökonomie, Stuttgart und Augsburg, 1858. Landed property, capital, and wage labour are thus transformed from sources of revenue, in the sense that capital attracts to the capitalist in the form of profit a portion of the surplus value extracted by him from labour, that monopoly in land attracts for the landlord another portion in the form of rent, and that labour grants the labourer the remaining portion of value in the form of wages, from sources by means of which one portion of value is transformed into the form of profit, another into the form of rent, and a third into the form of wages, into actual sources from which these value portions and respective portions of the product in which they exist, or for which they are exchangeable, arise themselves, and from which, therefore, in the final analysis, the value of the product itself arises. Footnote. Wages, profit, and rent are the three original sources of all revenue, as well as of all exchangeable value. Adam Smith, An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations, Aberdeen, London, 1848. It is thus that the causes of material production are at the same time the sources of the original revenues which exist. Storch, Cours d'Economie Politique, St. Petersburg, 1815. End of footnote. In the case of the simplest categories of the capitalist mode of production, and even of commodity production, in the case of commodities and money, we have already pointed out the mystifying character that transforms the social relations, for which the material elements of wealth serve as bearers in production, into properties of these things, commodities, themselves, and still more pronouncedly transforms the production relation itself into a thing, money. All forms of society, insofar as they reach the stage of commodity production and money circulation, take part in this perversion. But under the capitalist mode of production, and in the case of capital, which forms its dominant category, its determining production relation, this enchanted and perverted world develops still more. If one considers capital, to begin with, in the actual process of production as a means of extracting surplus labour, then this relationship is still very simple, and the actual connection impresses itself upon the bearers of this process, the capitalists themselves, and remains in their consciousness. The violent struggle over the limits of the working day demonstrates this strikingly. That even within this non-mediated sphere, the sphere of direct action between labour and capital, matters do not rest in this simplicity. With the development of relative surplus value in the actual, specifically capitalist mode of production, whereby the productive powers of social labour are developed, these productive powers and the social interrelations of labour in the direct labour process seem transferred from labour to capital. Capital thus becomes a very mystic being, since all of labour's social productive forces appear to be due to capital rather than labour as such, and seem to issue from the womb of capital itself. Then the process of circulation intervenes, with its changes of substance and form, on which all parts of capital, even agricultural capital, devolve to the same degree that the specifically capitalist mode of production develops. This is a sphere where the relations under which value is originally produced are pushed completely into the background. In the direct process of production, the capitalist already acts simultaneously as producer of commodities and manager of commodity production. Hence, this process of production appears to him by no means simply as a process of producing surplus value. But whatever may be the surplus value extorted by capital in the actual production process and appearing in commodities, the value and surplus value contained in the commodities must first be realized in the circulation process. And both the restitution of the values advanced in production and, particularly, the surplus value contained in the commodities seem not merely to be realized in the circulation, but actually to arise from it, an appearance which is especially reinforced by two circumstances. First, the profit made in selling depends on cheating, deceit, inside knowledge, skill, and 1,000 favourable market opportunities. And then, secondly, by the circumstance that added here to labour time is a second determining element, time of circulation. This acts, in fact, only as a negative barrier against the formation of value and surplus value, but it has the appearance of being as definite a basis as labour itself, and of introducing a determining element that is independent of labour and resulting from the nature of capital. In Volume 2, we naturally had to present this sphere of circulation merely with reference to the form determinations which it created and to demonstrate the further development of the structure of capital taking place in this sphere. But in reality, this sphere is the sphere of competition, which, considered in each individual case, is dominated by chance. Where, then, the inner law which prevails in these accidents and regulates them, is only visible when these accidents are grouped together in large numbers, where it remains, therefore, invisible and unintelligible to the individual agents in production. But furthermore, the actual process of production as a unity of the direct production process and the circulation process gives rise to new formations in which the vein of internal connections is increasingly lost. The production relations are rendered independent of one another, and the component values become ossified into forms independent of one another. The conversion of surplus value into profit, as we have noted, is determined as much by the process of circulation as by the process of production. Surplus value, in the form of profit, is no longer related back to that portion of capital invested in labour from which it arises, but to the total capital. The rate of profit is regulated by laws of its own, which permit or even require it to change, while the rate of surplus value remains unaltered. All this obscures more and more the true nature of surplus value, and thus the actual mechanism of capital. Still more is this achieved through the transformation of profit into average profit, and of values into prices of production, into the regulating averages of market prices. A complicated social process intervenes here, the equalization process of capitals, which divorces the relative average prices of the commodities from their values, as well as the average profits in the various spheres of production, quite aside from the individual investments of capital in each particular sphere of production, from the actual exploitation of labour by the particular capitals. Not only does it appear so, but it is true, in fact, that the average price of commodities differs from their value, thus from the labour realised in them. And the average profit of a particular capital differs from the surplus value which this capital has extracted from the labourers employed by it. The value of commodities appears directly solely in the influence of fluctuating productivity of labour upon the rise and fall of the prices of production, upon their movement, and not upon their ultimate limits. Profit seems to be determined only secondarily by direct exploitation of labour, insofar as the latter permits the capitalist to realise a profit deviating from the average profit at the regulating market prices, which apparently prevail independent of such exploitation. Normal average profits themselves seem inherent in capital and independent of exploitation. Abnormal exploitation, or even average exploitation under favourable exceptional conditions, seems to determine only the deviations from average profit, not this profit itself. The division of profit into profit of enterprise and interest, not to mention the intervention of commercial profit and profit from money dealing, which are founded upon circulation and appear to arise completely from it and not from the process of production itself, consummates the individualization of the form of surplus value, the ossification of its form as opposed to its substance, its essence. One portion of profit, as opposed to the other, separates itself entirely from the relationship of capital as such, and appears as arising not out of the function of exploiting wage labour, but out of the wage labour of the capitalist himself. In contrast thereto, interest then seems to be independent both of the labourer's wage labour and the capitalist's own labour, and to arise from capital as its own independent source. If capital originally appeared on the surface of circulation as a fetishism of capital, as a value-creating value, so it now appears again in the form of interest-bearing capital, as in its most estranged and characteristic form. Wherefore also, the formula capital interest, as the third to land rent and labour wages, is much more consistent than capital profit, since in profit there still remains a recollection of its origin, which is not only extinguished in interest, but is also placed in a form thoroughly antithetical to this origin. Finally, capital as an independent source of surplus value is joined by landed property, which acts as a barrier to average profit and transfers a portion of surplus value to a class that neither works itself nor directly exploits labour, nor can find morally edifying rationalizations, as in the case of interest-bearing capital, for example, risk and sacrifice of lending capital to others. Since here a part of the surplus value seems to be bound up directly with a natural element, the land, rather than with social relations, the form of mutual estrangement and ossification of the various parts of surplus value is completed, the inner connection completely disrupted, and its source entirely buried. Precisely because the relations of production, which are bound to the various material elements of the production process, have been rendered mutually independent. In capital profit, or still better, capital interest, land, rent, labour, wages, in this economic trinity represented as the connection between the component parts of value and wealth in general and its sources, we have the complete mystification of the capitalist mode of production, the conversion of social relations into things, the direct coalescence of the material production relations with their historical and social determination. It is an enchanted, perverted, topsy-turvy world, in which Monsieur le Capital and Madame la Terre do their ghost-walking as social characters, and at the same time directly as mere things. It is the great merit of classical economy to have destroyed this false appearance and illusion, this mutual independence and ossification of the various social elements of wealth, this personification of things and conversion of production relations into entities, this religion of everyday life. It did so by reducing interest to a portion of profit and rent to the surplus above average profit, so that both of them converge in surplus value, and by representing the process of circulation as a mere metamorphosis of forms, and finally, by reducing value and surplus value of commodities to labour in the direct production process. Nevertheless, even the best spokesmen of classical economy remain more or less in the grip of the world of illusion which their criticism had dissolved, as cannot be otherwise from a bourgeois standpoint, and thus they all fall, more or less, into inconsistencies, half-truths, and unsolved contradictions. On the other hand, it is just as natural for the actual agents of production to feel completely at home in these estranged and irrational forms of capital, interest, land, rent, labour, wages, since these are precisely the forms of illusion in which they move about and find their daily occupation. It is therefore just as natural that vulgar economy, which is no more than a didactic, more or less dogmatic, translation of everyday conceptions of the actual agents of production, and which arranges them in a certain rational order, should see precisely in this trinity, which is devoid of all inner connection, the natural and indubitable lofty basis for its shallow pompousness. This formula simultaneously corresponds to the interests of the ruling classes by proclaiming the physical necessity and eternal justification of their sources of revenue and elevating them to a dogma. In our description of how production relations are converted into entities and rendered independent in relation to the agents of production, we leave aside the manner in which the interrelations, due to the world market, its conjunctures, movements of market prices, periods of credit, industrial and commercial cycles, alternations of prosperity and crisis, appear to them as overwhelming natural laws that irresistibly enforce their will over them, and confront them as blind necessity. We leave this aside because the actual movement of competition belongs beyond our scope, and we need present only the inner organization of the capitalist mode of production in its ideal average, as it were. In preceding forms of society, this economic mystification arose principally with respect to money and interest-bearing capital. In the nature of things, it is excluded, in the first place, where production for the use value for immediate personal requirements predominates, and, secondly, where slavery or serfdom form the broad foundation of social production, as in antiquity and during the Middle Ages. Here the domination of the producers by the conditions of production is concealed by the relations of dominion and servitude, which appear and are evident as the direct motive power of the process of production. In early communal societies in which primitive communism prevailed, and even in the ancient communal towns, it was this communal society itself, with its conditions, which appeared as the basis of production, and its reproduction appeared as its ultimate purpose. Even in the medieval guild system, neither capital nor labour appear untrammelled, but their relations are rather defined by the corporate rules, and by the same associated relations, and corresponding conceptions of professional duty, craftsmanship, etc. Only when the capitalist mode of production... The manuscript breaks off here. Friedrich Engels.